Right, so there are several topics about which I wanted to speak. So I'll start with some digressions. Those would be somewhat different subjects. Those are three different subjects that one can say various things about. So I wanted to start from there. And then I'll discuss some applications of these kinds of observations for the problem of scale versus conformal invariants. I wanted to start with some discussion of the connection between high energy physics and short distance physics. So large momentum physics versus short distance physics. So just as this is a very confusing subject about which, as you'll see, there are no satisfactory general results. But at least I would be able to maybe convince you that there is something to be done, even though this is very old, of course. Now, of course, this talk would be far less sophisticated than previous talks here, so there would be no supersymmetry. The number of moving parts is very small, but yet I think one can say a few things that are not obvious. So in position space, if we have a correlation function in position space, so let's say that we're in CFT, in D dimensions. So I'll put it like that, CFTD. So we have a D dimensional CFT, and if we're interested in studying some separated point correlation function of some, let's say, primary operators, even though they don't need to be primary, and we're interested in the limit where x1 minus x2 is much smaller than all other separations. So if you just plot the location of this operator, so there is x1 and x2, which are very nearby. Yeah, let's do Euclidean. Actually, most of the talk, some of the talk would be Euclidean and some in Kafka. I'll try to remember when I switch, to tell you when I switch. So if we have such a configuration of operators, then we can replace this product of operators by a linear sum over the full set of operators in the theory. I'm just reminding you a well-known result. So that can be replaced by a sum of this sort over all the operators located without loss of generality at either x1 or x2 or at some other point in the middle. It doesn't matter. So and that we know that this expansion converges. So this is a convergent expansion. Now, let's consider the same problem in momentum space. So this is the story in position space. It's well established, and there are satisfactory arguments that show that this is true. Now, let's pass to momentum space. So we define the correlation function momentum space by just doing a Fourier transform, an ordinary Fourier transform of the correlation function in position space. I'll be completely careless about numerical factors throughout, both because I don't remember them and because they are not important.
Sorry, is there a snappy answer to why it's convergent?
Yeah, you can do a radial quantization and map it to the cylinder. And you can study the coefficients that appear in the expansion. And they're all smaller. I mean, there is this factor that you find in radial quantization. Yeah. And one can build a reasonably convincing argument that is convergent. No, so yes, you may need some mild assumptions. You may need, for example, that the spectrum is gapped.
What is the factor which you erase?
The spectrum of operators is gapped, of course. I mean, yeah.
No, what? I just didn't manage to see what is the factor of convergence.
What?
Depends on the dimension.
Oh no, this is just wasn't a reply to Greg's question of why is it convergent. Yeah. So I said that roughly speaking, operators of larger dimension are exponentially suppressed in radial quantization. So in momentum space, one can define this object, right? So So we can define this object with the usual Fourier factors. So plus, and we can study its high momentum behavior. So what do I mean by high momentum? For example, we can take P1 to be some P plus Q, P2 to be P minus Q, let's say minus Q, doesn't matter. So we can take P to be minus Q, and we can study, and we can ask, what is the high momentum limit of this correlation function? Right, so we can try to study that. And the answer, naively, would seem to be that we just Fourier transform the short distance singularities and we get the high momentum singularities. This is certainly what's being done, for example, in deep inelastic scattering and various other applications. So the naive answer is that the high momentum singularities are governed by short distance singularities because we're used, I mean, we're told in school, right, that short distance and high momentum is the same.
But in deep inelastic scattering, there are no other operators that can be used in infinity.
Yeah.
There are states.
Yeah, you can take the other operators to have very, very soft momenta, for example. So, you know, you can take P to be tiny, the other operators have very soft momenta, and you can.
No, but there are many pairs because you can go to higher twists, right?
So well, this, so the naive answer is that we just do Fourier transform, let's say Fourier transform term by term. That would conform with the intuition that high momentum is the same as short distance. And one can justify this naive answer by saying that, well, the Fourier transform is anyway not well-defined because of UV singularities when various points collide, right? We need to integrate over all the positions and various points may collide. So you need to define the Fourier transform. So the justification, the justification that you may find for this procedure is that we need to define Fourier transform by analytic continuation because there are various UV divergences. And so you analytically continue. You analytically continue to a region in which everything is manifestly convergent. And therefore, in that region, term by term integration is valid, right?
So you analytically continue what, in the conformal dimensions?
Yeah. You analytically continue in the conformal dimensions or maybe even the dimension itself. And then since you're analytically continuing to a region where everything is well defined, you can envision that in that region of parameter space, you can do a term-by-term integration by parts, term-by-term integration of this thing, and therefore the final answer must be consistent with that.
No, but look, if you consider data in a form that, say, you compensate their anomalous dimension, right? Let's say that we consider operators in such a way that, I mean, it's multiplied by proper coefficients in such a way that anomalous, I mean, total anomalous dimension is zero. Then everything is left-hand side is, I mean, ultraviolet fine. You can make
you're just
fine. Then right-hand side is also fine. Right?
Yeah, you are saying that this is obviously true. Okay, so
but you can characterize out this.
Okay, you're saying that the naive answer is obviously true. That you can just do it term by term.
Yeah.
So the first thing I want to say is that it's actually completely false. So this is the first thing that I want to say. So what I want to show you now is that this idea that short distance and high momentum is the same is completely false. This would be crucial to what I want to discuss. And actually, the theory of why this is false and how to make it systematic doesn't exist. I think that's an outstanding challenge.
Zafar, do you just mean that to do this for the singular terms in OP?
I'll give you an example now. I'll give you a simple example, all right?
Okay. But for the non-singular terms, it clearly is something.
So you'll see, I'll give you a very simple example. You'll see that it's false, and we can discuss maybe under which conditions it may or may not become true. So Arkady claimed that this is obviously true, and now we'll test this hypothesis.
No, it's not the focus in a sense that you're
okay
about factors, right?
Okay, so let's say study the correlation function of three operators whose dimension is d. You can think about them as some marginal operators in QCD, phi to the 4. So, and I'll take all of them to be identical and to have the same dimension, just to make the discussion simple. So the OP of three of those guys is, of course, the three-point function, we know it exactly, right? It's just this. So we know the three-point function exactly. And in principle, you can just put it in the integral and do the Fourier transform. The short distance singularities here arise from the fact that when O1 and O2, O at x1 and O at x2 collide, we find 1 over x1 minus x2 to the power d O at x1. So this is the explanation of the short distance singularities that we see in position space, completely consistent with the OP. The unit operator does not appear because the one-point function is taken to be zero. If we did a naive Fourier transform for that, right, we would find that O twiddle P plus Q, O twiddle at minus Q, it's basically the Fourier transform of these short distance singularities is a log. So we would find something like a log of Q squared, and then O twiddle at momentum P. That would be the naive Fourier transform of this singularity. So then, if one used that idea, if one took this idea seriously, you would be led to claim that the large momentum limit of O P plus Q, O minus Q, O at P, minus P, sorry. So you would be led to claim that this goes more or less like log of Q squared when Q is very, very large. And just to make up the dimension analysis fine, you need to stick a P to the 4. So there is some soft momentum here. This is just a numerical factor that doesn't scale with Q. And you would say that it's logarithmic in Q.
But you also should say log of Q squared divided by what?
Yeah, you can put a P squared if you like. Okay. So that would be the naive answer. This answer is completely false. You can do the computation, and you find Q to the 4. Log, various logs here. So this the OP, the naive idea that short distance singularity and high momentum singularities are the same is completely false. This is the right answer. This is the false answer.
I think that if I do Fourier transform, I'll get Boltzmann's.
No, I'm talking about the large momentum limit. I'm asking what's the leading term when Q is large. Okay? I'm not asking to compute the full. I'm just asking what's the leading answer when Q is large.
Is Q the fourth in any space dimension?
No. Yes. Yeah. No. No. I mean, sorry. This. I was thinking about.
Okay. When you say you do it exactly and that's what you get, you must have regularized it in some way.
Yeah. That's right. But you know, these three-point functions of marginal operators, there is a canonical way to regularize them. It's like this is essentially what computes the beta function in QCD. Mm-hmm. So the way to understand the beta function in terms of CFT is that you take a three-point function of marginal operators. This coefficient is what Gross and friends computed. This is exactly this. So you can argue the CFT avatar of the beta function is that the three-point function of marginal operators is non-zero. So it can be regularized in, there is a canonical way to regularize it. You can write it as an integral over three Bessel functions, expand the full answer, and you find that. So let me give you an interpretation.
Well, what's the canonical way to regularize it?
So the Fourier transform here is logarithmically divergent in various channels. And there may be even stronger singularities when many points overlap. So all the power divergences can be removed by contact terms. And what you should insist on, the canonical way to regularize such correlation functions is that you insist that the answer in momentum space obeys the conformal word identities. And that more or less fixes the answer completely. So there are various power divergences, and you just remove them. You can write the conformal word identities directly in momentum space. And they basically say that under rescaling the momentum, the whole thing behaves nicely. And that canonically removes all the power divergences. Let me explain why this happens.
You will have some kind of low energy ceiling, essentially, when you pass it, because we are saying that if you do naively, you will get this Q to the T tau term or what? Technically, what you will get if you...
This is the right answer. I'm just saying that this is the right answer.
Okay. But you said it's completely false, and then you give this very specific example of a marginal operator. I mean, it's completely...
Oh, false. You're saying that... Well, when
what
I said...
It's non-generic. What if you took G minus
epsilon? Yeah, I claim
then
that...
You don't need to regularize, so
I claim that also in that case it would fail. We've analyzed the conditions under which it fails, and they seem. We don't know the full story. I'll tell you exactly what I understand and what not. I understand why this fails. I understand why this fails, and I can also stick like a general dimension here and study as a function of delta when does it fail. The condition that we found is that delta is bigger than d over 2. As long as this holds, which includes your example d minus epsilon, we did not find that short distance and high momentum is the same. That's the condition that we found, but we did not analyze the most general setup. By no means. We don't have a theory. Just an observation that generically it fails.
A lot of it is being done in the context of what's called differential normalization or regularization. I mean, it's the same idea, like you have to define a proper distribution in position space that has a nice Fourier transform.
So there is a lot of work on, you take this function and you want to understand what is its Fourier transform. I'll actually discuss that a lot. This will be very important soon. The fact that the Fourier transform of that in four dimensions is P4 log of P squared is what you're referring to, theory of differential distribution. So. Yeah. But those people were just worried about, giving meaning to the Fourier transform of such angular functions. As far as we could see, nobody has ever discussed the relation between short distance physics and long distance physics and high momentum physics. Say again.
This is a theory of generalized functions, right?
Yes. That's, I think, exactly right. What Leonardo asked about.
That's right. But I'm saying.
So I think that this.
Just talking about Fourier transforms, it will be meaningless because it depends on that simple thing. So you have to think in terms of.
Yeah, so I think. Exactly. So the proper language is blah, 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 but. From conformal word. Yeah, we kind of know the answer from conformal word identities. Conformal word identities allow you to let's think about this example. The Fourier transform could have been two things by dimensional analysis: p to the 4 log p squared or p to the 4. How do you find that there is a log? Because if there were no log, that would be a polynomial, which would mean that there is no correlation function at separated points. So as far as I'm concerned, all such subtleties can be dealt with by just imposing conformal word identities. I did not see like a major result in that theory, as far as I didn't like understand from this.
They used to do calculations much easier than any other scheme. So
yeah. Okay.
So this does not seem to explain that.
This is completely disparate. So yeah. This is completely this observation that short distance does not correspond to large momentum, as far as I could say, is not in the literature.
I want to
explain physically why this happens, and maybe that would be the beginning of the theory that explains.
Let me remind that, say, for example, we use this operator product expansion, say, for this
deep in elastic.
Rules, right? And there, this term Q.
Yeah, but I did not use that. You used that.
And this term Q to the fourth, but multiplied by log, naturally appeared. For example, if it's correlated over energy momentum tensor, right? So if you're doing just normal finite diagram, you see that.
I'm just saying that this is the right answer, and this does not come from short distance. It doesn't come from the OP. You can't understand that in any OP-like language. There's no momentum space OP as far as... I'll explain that. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll see that there is no momentum space OP, even though many people use that.
But log reflects this singularity in X space, right? The only remaining singularity in Fourier transform it is log, right? Because otherwise it's polynomial, right? Okay, so what is wrong with this?
With what?
No, I mean, you have Q to some power multiplied by log, right?
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that the answer that you would get from doing an OP in momentum space is wrong. I'm just saying that the OP in momentum space, if you just literally take it to be the Fourier transform of the OP in position space, is wrong. Mm-hmm. So short-distance singularities in position space do not imply anything useful about large momentum singularities. That's all I'm saying.
Is this basically a shadow operator that's showing? When you compute conformal blocks...
I think it might be. It might be related.
Okay.
I think it might be related. You'll see it in a second. This interpretation... I'll try to explain why this happens. And maybe that will be useful. So one particular case of this correlation function that we can understand physically is the case when p equals to 0. Okay, that's a special case in which I can explain why this must be the right answer without any computation. And it also kind of explains how one should proceed to develop a systematic theory of momentum space, OP. In that case, O of zero that we have here can be viewed as an integral over O. And that can be viewed as a deformation of the Lagrangian, a deformation of the Lagrangian. All right? So we're just adding some leading order effect from deforming the Lagrangian. It cannot always be viewed like that, but in this special case it can. And so we're basically what we're doing is that we can interpret this, so this can be reinterpreted as a two-point function at zero at of O at Q and minus Q in some new background. Okay? And this new background is to leading order conformally invariant. The beta function kicks in much later, if at all. And therefore, we just use a dimensional analysis to find that it's q to the 4 log of q squared. So the fact that the large q behavior is what I said can be understood in this simplistic fashion. Q to the d, yeah. And then there may not be a log. Yeah, depending on d, there may not be a log. The log appears only in even dimensions. So, okay. Let's do d equals 4.
This is just a question of exchange of limits.
Yeah, but normally one is told that these limits are the same. The short distance and high momentum is the same.
Not x to 0 and q to infinity, but p to 0 and
p to 0.
Oh, you mean... No, this limit, this exchange of limits is completely fine. This correlation function is completely regular as a function of p.
It's fine, but the are taken.
This is completely fine. I mean, the limit of p going to 0 is completely continuous. This is completely fine. This correlation function is the behavior when p is finite.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's fine. It has different limits.
Yeah, so I'm just saying that if one studies p over q much, much smaller than 1, the answer is always q to the 4. And I'm just giving you an example when p is 0. So when p is much, much smaller than q, q to the 4 always dominates.
Yeah. But so you can follow up and calculate next terms in a pair of expansion which are the higher dimension. And
yeah, now you can ask what's the theory.
And then you
okay.
Get one over q.
So you see that one can essentially understand this thing as if this, so this comes from the unit operator, in fact,
yeah.
Right? So you see that something very strange has happened. So even though the OP originally was contributed by O and not by the unit operator, by the time we went to momentum space, the OP can be understood by the unit operator almost. Not by O. Not precisely, but almost by the unit operator. Anyway, so the idea, I will not say much more about that. It will be important in what I say next, but I basically leave it at that. So the idea is that one can understand large momentum limits as if one is studying some high-energy process in some soft background of some sort. And maybe one can develop a systematic theory for how to understand Q going to infinity limits. So it can be understood, perhaps, as a studying. So one can maybe get rid of all, so the idea in OP is, of course, that you get rid of all the other operators, and you just study the two operators that are interesting. And this is suggestive in the sense that maybe you can get rid of all the soft operators and just replace it by some new background, some quantum numbers, and then redo the OP for the two-point function, in some sense. Perhaps as studying some, let's say, lower point functions, in a new background, in a new soft background, soft in some imputation, soft background. Okay, so I actually don't know how to do that, but we've checked many examples and it seems like a generic fact. The short distance does not have anything to say about large momentum.
So if you find that a matrix element, there would a third-part operator in there, it would be interchangeable. I mean, the field theory texts, they go back and, I mean, they usually formulated in mental space. I think it's best because you're talking about matrix elements of the operator front rather than having a third operator in there.
So you're saying that this language might not be general?
I'm saying suppose you had, instead of a three-point function, it's a two-point function, but not in vacuum.
Okay.
In general, then I think in that context.
In some other state?
In some other, between some other states.
States.
I think in that context, you could do what you want. You could Fourier transform.
I think so. I think there is a great difference between studying something like deep inelastic.
Yes, that's what we
Which is a two-point function in some state versus studying endpoint correlation functions. I think it's very different. I believe in deep inelastic.
But once you allow yourself to take different matrix.
So actually, I want to.
Everything.
I want to. So the person who convinced me that in deep inelastic it might be okay is Juan Maldacena. But I think for endpoint functions, it's still true that there is this issue that one doesn't have an analog of the operator product expansion. So I think there is a subtle difference between states and endpoint functions. Juan had some intuition from ADS-60 why deep inelastic should be okay.
Let me return to this point about recognizing that, let's say they consider the product of the operator, okay? And that's generically, I do not need to take vacuum average. Let's say they consider just the product of the operator and then taking matrix element of arbitrary state, right? So, and it is a way to separate out, you know, different operators, right? Because let's say we are looking product of the operator, we are saying, aha, this could be the unit operator. So to take unit operator, I can take average or vacuum. To find the operator, you know, next one, I can take matrix element.
I completely agree that for states, if you want to evaluate correlation functions, two-point functions in some state, the short distance and high momentum commute.
Yeah.
But I think in endpoint functions, they do not commute.
What is
end? Endpoint functions.
I mean,
endpoint correlation functions.
Thank God, that theory is well tested experimentally.
But when you have endpoint functioning.
Well, actually, it's not quite true because they just use the states that they use in deep inelastic are in some sense light. Mm-hmm. So they could evade this. Bound, so it's not completely clear.
But then, when you say endpoint function, if we take only one distance small, right, then the only reason for that, what you are saying, could be because of a large momentum going sidewise, right? Because if large momentum is between these two operators, then everything else I can try to view as a background, right? No, it's the way as you said, right?
Yeah, that's what I said.
Okay, but in the background, then we'll say it's matrix element, right?
No, that's not true.
Not true.
It does not become a matrix element. Mm-hmm. This new background is in quotation marks. It cannot be viewed as a state in the original theory.
Uh-huh.
I don't know in what sense there is a new background, but well, this calculation is suggestive. Okay, a final comment about that is that you could ask, where does this sickness come from in the actual Fourier transform? So when you take Q to be very large, you would have thought that the distance between X1 and X2 is over the order 1 over Q. That's the usual expectation from the relation between short distance and high momentum. And actually, if you look at this integral carefully for this three-point function that we discussed, you find that the contribution does not come from that region, but it comes from the region where the distance between x1 and x2 is over the order of the distance between x1 and x3, say. And they may or may not be one of the order of 1 over q. So these high energy limits of correlation functions, they correspond to something that is beyond the radius of convergence of the OP. So it's like a multi-singularity limit. Say again. So Q, the operators that want to approach each other are 1 and 2. And so X3 is large, is finite. So that's your naive expectation, that high momentum in the operators O1 and O2 would make them look like they're very close in position space. But actually, if you look at the integral, the saddle point of the integral is when the other operator suddenly comes in very close to, and it jeopardizes the OP.
X1 minus
XQ. So I'm starting this P plus Q minus Q, O3 minus P. And the corresponding position space thing is X1, X2, X3.
But
Okay, so I'm just saying that when you take u to be very large, the momentum exchange between these guys is very large, and you would expect that x1 becomes very close. But what actually happens is this. And so, I think.
But I agree with about this point, but this corresponds, it always happened before because it corresponds to the following. When you consider product of your operators, right? Then, and doing operator of expansion. Essentially, what you are saying, I mean, I can formulate it just in different languages to say that when you're doing operator of expansion, this operator expansion, you know, corresponding to two operators at the same point, and this new operator expansion corresponds to the three operators at the same point.
Yeah, this is multi-OP.
Yeah, multi-OP, right. And when
so,
analyzing finite diagram, you should explicitly.
So one thing that I want to say is that if you study these correlation functions as a general function of dimensions of the various different operators, the saddle point may move. So there may be various factors of delta in these formulas. And you may be able to recover OP in some limits of delta. So the particular question that doesn't have a concrete answer, as far as I could say, is what's the general condition for a short distance to correspond to high momentum? This is just for a very special case, three-point functions where all the operators have the same dimension. But there is an outstanding question of what's the general story, what's the general theory for high momentum expansion? And is there a way to understand some leading terms? So here I've just discussed the leading term in Q, but there are of course many, many sub-leading terms that are down by various powers of P over Q. So is there a systematic theory to understand those?
Can you modify your OP there to make it work?
Yeah, so that's the first thing you would think. Is there something like a new momentum space OP that doesn't have anything to do with position space OP? Or maybe such things don't exist. Maybe this kind of equation suggests that it can never exist.
No,
because
no,
you see that more than two operators are involved.
Power counting essentially.
Say again?
If you look at the point where all the x's coincide, you have 3D,
yeah,
and 2D upstairs,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so.
But that's precisely the. That's precisely why it comes out to be Q to the 4 in the end of the day.
But you see, you can differentiate it because if you are taking metric saving, for example, instead of.
So it may not be possible to differentiate.
Then you are indeed.
It may not be possible to. It's still an outstanding question for me whether there is a sense in which there is momentum space OP, because this equation may suggest that there isn't. Because you see, it corresponds to a very complicated singularity of the full thing.
No, I agree. But
so it's an outstanding question. I just don't know.
Right, but in terms of states, it corresponds to the mixture of states with very large momenta, right? Essentially, when you are doing this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you have a solution, then I would be
no, happier. But technically, when you're doing a periodic expansion in the application, you are.
This is just the first digression.
This is just
the first digression that I wanted to make. It's not. I'm not going to make a big deal out of that. I just want to move on.
All the contributions that you find, which are not naive, possible to be interpreted as a shadow of, namely, of the form d minus delta.
Maybe there is a So this is one of the things I was trying to think about shadow OP. Because in this example, you really see that this comes from that example that I gave here. You really see it comes from the shadow of this operator, which has essentially dimension zero.
Shadow is a non-local relative.
So maybe one can reformulate the OP in terms of shadow operators, and it will be very natural in that way.
What is a shadow operator?
It's like an operator that has dimension d minus delta. So the shadow of an operator of dimension delta is a non-local operator, which has nice conformal properties, and has formally dimension d minus delta. It's just an integral over this thing, which has nice conformal properties, nice formal conformal properties. So this derivation here suggests that you should do an OP expansion in terms of shadows.
Is it a canonical way of giving us a delta to produce the shadow?
Yes, there is a shadow. This is by Ferraro and Grillo, I believe, from 78.
But if
this is very useful in computing conformal blocks or stuff.
Still, let me ask you, let's say I'm doing explicit Fourier calculation with this correlation function. In terms of Feynman diagram. Then in terms of Feynman diagram, of course, I will find out the case where one momenta is large going through the diagram, right? I mean, you have external momenta going through, and you can find just explicitly find out.
I think you're just trying to say that this result is.
Right? It doesn't contradict to what you're saying.
Yeah, so let's leave it at that.
But in application, people do it. I mean, when you have a real application where more operators than two, so then you have.
I don't want to make a big deal out of that. I just pointed out the curiosity.
Uh-huh.
You can leave it at that, and that's it.
Okay.
But I do think that there is a theory missing of how to understand high momentum limits.
I mean, as you just said from the very beginning, there was a very good theory of the OBE.
In position space.
If you take 2 points together.
Yeah, position space.
So you take 3 points.
That's right.
Even in position space.
That's correct, but this derivation here suggests that there is a way to think about that.
Yeah, right.
Nevertheless, even though in position space, this equation might be discouraged by this equation, that it seems hopelessly complicated. But I think it's not the case, because if you view it in this way, it suddenly seems manageable. That you can think about this, you can still separate the soft background from the operators that have high momentums in some way, and then the question is whether you can do something with these two operators that have large momentum exchange that would always be true, regardless of the new background, and then you just plug the new background. And I believe the answer is possibly yes, but I'm not sure. This would be just a small point when I get to the bulk of the talk, which doesn't seem very good. This is just the first digression. Yes, there was another question.
I was just going to say that there's a systematic way to kind of chop up your correlator into pieces where different OPEs are correct using these monotomy tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that should also work in momentum space, so you should be able to take the Fourier transform correlator and explicitly break it up into pieces where the different OPEs are correct.
You mean OPEs in momentum space?
Yeah, I mean, well,
so the high momentum limits, or what?
Right. So when you in the position space, you take a pair of points and you continue them into the complex plane and back, and that picks out the piece of the correlator where it basically puts in a theta function that enforces convergence of the OPE.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying you could probably do that same trick in momentum space to find the piece of the momentum space computation that's coming from the position-based correlator.
Yeah, but the thing that is scary is that the main contribution, the leading one, comes from entropy region in position space.
Right. So, okay. Well, I don't know what would happen, but I mean, it would be interesting.
I'm just leaving it. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
I think it's there is this basic question that seems to have no answer in the literature, and it's an interesting one.
Why is this interesting? Why should you care about this Fourier transform?
No, correlation functions in momentum space are very important in many, many applications. I can list them if you want, but there are many applications in which one would like to understand correlation functions in momentum.
Getting no doubt, but those are different problems.
Not dependent elastics, not just that. For example, well, if you want just the very recent applications, for example, if you want the, well, some recent applications involving this, you know, conformal collider physics.
Those are generally different forms.
They're slightly different,
yeah,
I agree, but you'll see one application of momentum space correlation functions that may or may not. But it's a basic question about the QFT that doesn't seem to have an answer. I mean, one could also ask why do we care about position space correlation functions?
Because they have nice properties with respect to P.
In what? With respect to what?
With respect to the OP.
No, that's maybe those also have nice properties with respect to momentum space, and then it would be self-justified, you know, we could justify momentum space because they have some nice properties too.
But if you're saying that the OBE of 3 points, you bring 3 points together in some way.
Yeah.
Related to the deformation of the momentum or something like that.
Yeah.
How do you see that evolution?
I think that the way you see that in position space is that we have three operators, so two are very close, and the third one is all integrated over it, and the saddle point comes from the point where this comes close to this guy. So, as you know, deforming the Lagrangian is more or less the same as putting saying that, oh, so this is the guy that deforms the Lagrangian. So, what I'm trying to say is that deformations of the Lagrangian correspond to short distance limits. Those contact terms at short distances or OPs. I'm trying to say something quite vague. But I think the effect of deforming the Lagrangian by a marginal operator on some local operator comes from when this operator is very, very close. Because of dimensional analysis, there is a log enhancement when this is very, very close. I don't know if it's a satisfactory answer, but
the integral over
that's
X is the condition that at these short distances you have
two points together.
That's what I was saying.
Yes. Somewhere, and there is an integral.
Yeah, I'm just saying that this integral, if you just keep that in that case.
Is what? The integral over the third point is convergent at distances of the order x1 minus x2. And it would be example of this type.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a completely general story, because you could also deform the Lagrangian by mass terms, and then it would seem that it's different. So I don't have a completely satisfactory answer.
I'm moving on.
Yeah, it might be that momentum space correlation functions are crappy, or they might have like, you know, great properties and useful. We won't know until we check, right?
So,
yeah, the OPE is always simpler to think about composition space. You're giving an example where there are two contributions that all three points come together.
Yeah, but if it, on the other hand, comes from the unit operator in some other interpretation.
Yeah, but it isn't actually the unit operator.
Yeah,
that would have no expectation.
No,
the unit operator doesn't contribute.
No, it does. That's what I try to convince you. That it's the unit operator in the deformed theory.
Yeah.
So it might be even simpler. Yeah, so you see that it might be that even if this story is general, it might even suggest that the OPE in position in momentum space is even simpler than in position space. Because, you know, previously it came from O and now it comes from the unit operator. But it's renormalized unit operator in some vague sense.
No, just that in position space I can separate the two kinds of contributions. One where two points come together and I have a convergent expansion, the other where all three points are coming together. And I'm not even sure what the expansion means.
That's right, but you see that there is one can interpret it as a unit operator in the new background.
I'm just
I completely agree.
But it would be like two different.
No, at this point, I think it's fair to say that we don't know whether momentum space correlation functions simplify or do not simplify the same. Maybe that they're crappy or it may be that they're simple. I just don't know. And there is some circumstantial evidence that they are simple in some sense. So, okay, the second digression is the anomalous version of CFTs. So that's so now it's about, let's take an operator of dimension D. And now I'm going to take, and now I'm going to be in four dimensions, and still Euclidean. So that's another small, that's another subtlety about CFTs that is not very familiar, even though this is familiar to experts. Well, this one I think was not even familiar to experts. So we take two marginal operators in position space, and as long as x is not equal to zero, by conformal invariance, the answer is 1/(x^8). And that answer is the correct one, and it's definitely consistent with conformal invariance at separated points. But the thing about it is that if you check the word identity, very schematically, acting on this correlation function, it's not completely conformally invariant at coincident points. So one finds the box squared of delta 4x. So there is an anomaly at coincident points. Okay, so some correlation functions. So while the previous issue that I mentioned, this large momentum failure to be the same as short distance, is very, very generic, this is very special. This only occurs in some maybe even dimensions and some very special operators. So this box squared of delta x does not break conformal invariance. Just because conformal invariance doesn't care about what happens at coincident points, strictly speaking. But it does have implications, but it does lead to very interesting word identities. So you do want to study this delta function. It does lead to word identities, non-trivial word identities for hyperbolic functions. Okay, so this is an important piece, even if it seems a bit innocuous. So in momentum space, one can quite immediately see what's going on. If you Fourier transform 1/(x^8), the only consistent answer you can write down is p^4 log p squared over mu squared. You can't really write down just p^4, because that would mean that there is no correlation function at separate points. And you see that under p going to lambda p, this thing picks up a contact term, p^4 times log lambda, right? So that's this delta function. This is exactly this delta function, that under rescaling the momentum, the correlation function is not invariant, but it's only invariant up to local terms. And one of the things that that will be very important when I finally not get to what I wanted to tell you is that this leads to a very strong word identity, which contains the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so this silly contact term leads to some very strong result about that. This should have been crucial in the discussion that we will not have. Okay, the final digression, so this is the final digression. This is generalized free fields.
But then because of course it is for dimensional space, right?
For D.
For D, but then Fourier transform of 1 over x square.
X to the 8.
Fourier transform of 1 over x square, I would think that it
1 over x to the 8.
I see.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So generalized free field is the following idea. You take a well-established CFT, like the Ising model, and you want to add to it another local operator O, such that the two-point function O of O is 1 over x to some 2 delta. So the dimension of this guy would be delta. It doesn't matter in how many dimensions we're now. So you want to add another operator O, such that its two-point function is that. But the endpoint function is given by a sum over a weak contraction. So there are no connected correlation functions. Okay, so you just take an ordinary, well-established CFT and you add a free field of dimension delta. So the question is whether this procedure is consistent and it leads to a new CFT, which contains the previous operators plus this new operator with this set of rules. And now I'll explain why the answer in CFTs is that this is an inconsistent procedure that's well known to experts. And I will then define the problem that I want to solve.
You introduce tensor product factor.
Exactly, with these rules.
So it's just the sum of the coupled system?
Not quite, because the energy momentum tensor must act on O. So you just...
The energy momentum tensor can be sum of the one for conformal field theory and the one for O.
So you'll see that in one sense, one can rule this out. Okay, so if one studies the four-point function, so to rule this out, one studies the four-point function, which is given by 1 over x minus x1 minus x2 to the power 2 delta, x3 minus x4 to the power 2 delta, plus permutations. Okay? So one can now read out the spectrum of fields that propagate in the OPE. So we can do a position space OP. So we can do now read out the spectrum of fields that propagate in the OP. So let's define these guys to have two quantum numbers, the dimension and the spin. So what one finds is that the dimension is given by 2 delta. That's not a good notation, sorry. So I'll call this delta naught. This would be delta naught, so that I don't run into some notation problem. So, and n is a natural number. So one, just by analyzing the spectrum of operators that appear in the OP, one finds this spectrum, where s is the spin, n is a natural number, and delta naught is the dimension of the original operator. And now one can observe that this does not contain the energy momentum tensor unless delta naught is d over 2 minus 1. So this does not contain, so it does not contain an operator of spin 2 of dimension d. It does not contain an operator which is spin 2 and dimension, so my notation is dimension d and spin 2. So it only contains in this series such an operator if this is satisfied, and this is of course a free field. This is the ordinary Landau-Ginzburg free field, which we can always add, of course. But now, why is this a problem? Why does it have to contain the energy momentum tensor? So here one uses crucially a certain property of CFTs that would not be available for scale invariant field theories. So why is this important? Why does OO need to contain the energy momentum tensor? Here one uses crucially the fact that the OPE coefficients in CFTs are symmetric. And this is sometimes not emphasized, but this is an extremely crucial property of CFTs. So the symmetry of OPE coefficients, this is essentially what CFTs buy you. The fact that there is associativity is completely trivial in some sense, because they just, it's true even in scaling parent filters. But the symmetry of the OPE is the key. So the symmetry of the OPE means that if the energy momentum tensor is not contained in OO, then O is not contained in T mu nu O. And that's a killer, because that violates translational invariance. T mu nu must act as translation on O. So one can really rule out these generalized free fields other than the free field case. Now, so what I wanted to tell you in more detail is the how does one go about doing that for scale invariant filters? Because this is a loophole in the argument why scale invariance implies conformal invariance. This is a loophole that was stated in the original papers. And it can be ruled out. So I wanted to explain to you how you do that without using the symmetry of the OP. So I'll probably not be able to get to that. I'll just tell you that it can be done. But I'll tell you more or less why this is a loophole. So, of course, for example,
you're saying that symmetry OP can just say that three-point function O T mu is fixed by conformal symmetry.
Yeah, that's why the OP is symmetric.
Or the other way around.
Yeah, these are logical equivalent statements.
But you're saying it's not emphasized. Well, it's emphasized, but
no, I'm just saying that the bootstrap equation CC equals CC, this is also true in scale invariant filters. This is not interesting. The interesting thing is that C is symmetric. That's where the constraints really come from.
In scale invariant filters, you have a bootstrap equation for the three-point function.
Yes, in some sense. So, so of course, Joe has done a lot of work on this problem already in the 80s, and more recently with Marco Spluti and Riccardo Ratazzi. And there are many other papers on this subject, even just three papers from the last week, in fact. So there is some spur of activity trying to understand this problem. So I won't give you any, I won't try to give proper credit who did what and so on. I'll just give you a streamlined argument and maybe just go 5 minutes over time of just to get to the point that you would see why this is an issue. So instead of being very abstract and formal, I'll do a very physical thought experiment, which is very much similar to what Joe and I, with various people, did in various papers. So we'll consider an energy flow between two CFTs. So no SFT is involved yet. So there could be many RG flows between CFT A and CFT B, and they could be very different. And the thought experiment that one can do is that somewhere in phase space, in the space of theories, there is a scale invariant field theory. Okay, which what is the scale invariant field theory? It's a theory in which the energy momentum tensor is not traceless. It has scale invariance, but the energy momentum tensor is not traceless. So it doesn't have the three-point function miracle that Slava just mentioned. It just has overall scaling transformations, but no special conformal transformations. Okay, so that's the setup. So we don't know whether such theories exist in general, but in four dimensions, one can make a very strong argument against their existence. So one just imagines a Gedanken experiment that we can with some RG flows, get very, very close to that SFT, so we can spend a lot of time, a lot of RG time, right, near the CFT, near the SFT, sorry. Okay. Okay, so this is the setup. Not every CFT can presumably be approached like that, but one can call this the visiting scenario or the hovering scenario, visiting scenario. Okay, so let's see what are the consequences of this Gedanken experiment. So from this Gedanken experiment, one can almost rule out the SFT the existence of SFTs, and that's extremely beautiful. So I'll show you why this almost leads to a contradiction. And then, of course, one can relax the assumptions. One doesn't really need the visiting scenario. It's just meant to be extremely clear, where there are no subtleties, no loopholes. So the key thing is that these RG flows are very different, but there is one invariant, which is that the A anomaly of the CFT in the UV is always the same. It's an inherent quantity. It doesn't care which RG flow you triggered. And of course, the A anomaly of the CFT in the infrared is always the same. It doesn't care how you got there. It's an inherent quantity of the CFT. The thing is that it can be written as an integral over the RG flow. So it can be written as an integral over the RG flow of a four-point function of T mu mu. So this is some positive measure. There is some positive measure. And then there is a four-point function in some special kinematics that I'm not going to specify because I won't have time.
But are they in different point or?
They're in momentum space. This is why I started from momentum space. Uh-huh. They're in momentum space. So this is one application where momentum space correlation functions appear in some rules. So as you know, some rules always involve momentum space correlation functions. So that's one application. Yeah, in fact, I should have emphasized that this is one place where such momentum space correlation functions appear, and high momentum limits are very important. Okay, so there is such a result. And the surprising thing about it is that T mu mu is zero here, and it's zero here, and it's non-zero in the flow. But the integral doesn't depend on the flow. So this is an invariant of the RG flow. If you change the RG flow by, you know, tuning the mass parameters a little differently, it would not change the integral. This is very much RG dependent, but the integral is not. So it's like a total derivative almost, which is very, very important. So this is RG dependent, but the integral is not. Okay, so this is very surprising, but it's true. And now one can almost get a contradiction, because this is a function of the RG time. And let's call this RG time S. Let me just specify the measure. The measure is ds over s cubed, where s is something that's related to the RG. This is some momentum scale, okay? And this is some function of s, of one variable s. And this is some positive measure. So if you assume that such a CFT exists, SFT exists in the space of theories, and you can get arbitrarily close to it, you can use dimensional analysis to estimate this thing very close to the SFT. And you get in this convention, you would just get S squared by dimensional analysis, because there is no other scale in an SFT, so you can use dimensional analysis. So once you see that if an SFT exists in the space of theories, and if this coefficient C, very crucially, is not zero, then one finds C times the log of the RG time of entry over time of exit. And if you can tune the RG flow to be arbitrarily close to the SFT, this can be made arbitrarily large or small, whatever you want, depending on the sign of the thing. So one gets a contradiction. And one therefore finds that C is zero. Okay? Now, this is a positive definite correlation function. So the fact that C is zero almost means that each object in this correlation function is zero. It's not quite enough, but it's almost true. One can make it a bit stronger. What was done recently is that this was generalized. This sum rule with a positive definite measure was generalized to an arbitrary number of T mu mu's. And one can use similar logic to prove that all of them are all the coefficients are zero. So let's call those guys Cn. So all of them are zero.
But the sum rule is valid when the invariant momentum square carried by each operator is zero, right?
Yeah, yeah, I did not specify the exact kinematics.
It would be enough that it vanishes just...
I did not specify the kinematics. I'm just saying that this whole thing depends on one parameter. I did not specify the kinematics. I don't have time to specify precisely the kinematics of these correlation functions. But they all depend on essentially one parameter in some sense. And one can prove that all of those coefficients are zero. This can be used, the fact that all of them are zero, this can be used via some analogy to an S-matrix experiment, some Gedanken experiment where you can do an S-matrix thing. This can be used to imply that scale invariant. This can be used to argue that scale invariance implies conformal invariance. So the vanishing of all of these coefficients, let's call this C1, can be used in analogy to some S-matrix story to show that the theory is trivial. So this last step is based on some similarity of these correlation functions with the theory, the correlation functions that appear in S-matrix theory. And there is, it's known that a trivial S-matrix means a trivial theory. So we're using the same argument. A trivial S-matrix means the trivial theory. In this sense, in this setup, trivial theory means conformal theory. Because suppose this theory is actually conformal and you did not notice it. So then the trace of the energy momentum tensor is zero. In some sense, there is a small subtlety here, but I don't have time to get to that. It's basically zero, and then there is no contradiction because C is zero. So a trivial theory in this setup means conformal theory. Now, this argument has one loophole, which was already emphasized in the paper of Zhou and Luke and Ricardo and re-emphasized in a recent paper of me, Adam, Tolia, and Stefan. And that the thing is that these correlation functions are connected. That's what one gets when one writes these sum rules carefully. It does not mean that they are not positive. Connected correlation functions in appropriate configurations are still positive because one can use the optical theorem. But it's very important that they are connected. So there is a loophole. What if they all vanish because there are no connected diagrams? So the loophole is, what if T mu mu is a generalized free field? That's the loophole. Then there are no connected diagrams whatsoever, and the argument is moot. And that is the thing that one can rule out using all these digressions and the anomalies very, very strongly, using word identities for anomalous correlation functions and many other little things that I glossed over. One can rule out this possibility. So one can prove that what one can prove completely rigorously, and there are no loopholes in that story. One can really prove that this correlation function at separated points is non-zero. So it cannot be a generalized free field. It's not given by weak constructions. So that's all I wanted to say.
But in your paper, you say, okay, you remove the loophole, but there remains a still smaller loophole.
It's like a Russian matryoshka. There are still the smaller loopholes that always are there.
So why do you have to claim more than what you say?
I'll just answer that very quickly. So one, the only loophole that exists is the T mu mu is a generalized free field. That's just one thing. The question is whether you need to make extra assumptions to prove that it's not a generalized free field. It's like a matryoshka, right? And actually, to prove that this is non-zero using these word identities and all the machinery that I explained, or did not explain, we needed to make an assumption. And the assumption is that the theory does not have operators of dimension exactly two. So now there is a smaller loophole. But you know, for generic theories where there is no reason why there would be an operator of dimension exactly two, this is completely well established. It's a rigorous result. I want to mention that whether the energy momentum tensor can be a generalized free field is an extremely non-trivial problem. Our argument relies very strongly on this 1 over x to the 8, on the Fourier transform of 1 over x to the 8 that has this box of delta, and it leads to word identities for higher point functions. But if you, for example, ask me whether that can be the case in three dimensions, I don't know. We have absolutely no idea of how to. This is an extremely non-trivial question in SFTs. In CFTs, it's like one blackboard, right? The symmetry of the OP coefficients.
But in SFTs, it's extremely hard to decide whether there can exist generalized free fields. I don't know if there can be generalized free fields in SFTs because we don't have the OP symmetry, the symmetry of the OP coefficients argument. So for this very particular case, in four dimensions, for the energy momentum tensor, we managed to rule it out by some complicated use of anomalies, long and some pretty complicated story using these word identities for anomalies. But other than that, there is no claim. But even that argument failed if there is an operator of exactly dimension two, and that's the only problem.
But
so it remains.
But what is the lesson in four dimensions? So I say that, you know, this conformal invariants comes together with but this is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just saying that up to a very, very marginal case where there is an operator of dimension exactly two and T is it, and the energy momentum sensor is a generalized free field, there is a very compelling argument, I think. That implies that shows that every scale invariant field theory is in fact has special conformal transformations.
It's curious to see what's wrong with your paper on dimension two.
I can't explain it very simply. But at some point one analyzes concept terms and word identities, and at some point if there is an operator of dimension two, one can't make progress.
Can you say anything about non-unitary scale invariant theories, for instance, the multi-point functions?
So actually it's very interesting. But this is still true. The fact C1 is equal to 0, or Cn equals to 0, is still true. But it doesn't imply something incredibly strong, because one cannot use the op. So the fact that C is equal to 0 is still true. And if you take your favorite elasticity theory, which is scale invariant but not conformal, you compute this thing, and it's 0. The Cn coefficients are 0. One can compute them, and within that, they're 0. It's a miraculous consolation of positive states in the Hilbert space against negative states in the Hilbert space. And they exactly cancel. In unitary theories, there are no negative states in the Hilbert space, and this can be formally written as something squared. So one can say much more. But it's even true that this is zero in non-unitary theories. And it requires some miraculous consolation between the positive norm states and negative norm states.
Known previously?
No. Everything that I said is more or less from the last 3 years. There are many papers about the subject.
Not so many about non-unitary.
Oh, the fact that this vanish, that all of these coefficients vanish in non-unitary theories. This is something that one can figure out in a few days. It's not so complicated.
So in the end, you didn't use the hovering?
No. This hovering was just to make the discussion more or less intuitively compelling, but one doesn't need it. One can prove that all of these coefficients are zero without the hovering story. Yes?
I'm wondering, as you're looking for very esoteric theories anyhow, you had this theory which was not translational invariant, which you ruled out. Can you elaborate more?
No, but I'm still restricting myself to some class of theories. Lorentz invariant, translational invariant, local theories. I'm just looking, for the space of theories within that framework. Lorentz invariant, translational invariant, local theories.
But here it's just translational, not Lorentz, right?
No, I'm using very strongly Poincaré and locality all the time. Locality is manifested in the form that there is an energy momentum tensor. And Poincaré is used, everywhere, all the time. Otherwise, if you don't have Poincaré, it's not clear what you mean by CFT, because there is no canonical single enlargement of the group. There are many possibilities because time is not the same thing as space, So it's not unique, and of course, then everything flows and expands. But this is a restricted set of theories. And actually, they're not esoteric. I completely disagree that they're esoteric. The question of whether, Poincaré invariant theories are conformal is extremely important for three-dimensional dynamics, for example, for condensed matter systems. Because they observe Poincaré invariants as an emergent phenomenon all the time. And scale invariants is guaranteed at every second order phase transition by the Landau theory. So it's an extremely important question whether they always have special conformal transformations, and whether three-point functions are fixed.
So I can give you countless examples in condensed matter physics where they would love to know whether it's a conformal theory or not. We just don't know. Even for boiling water, we don't know. Nobody proved that the ice model is conformal. So
experimentally, no, it's conformal.
Yeah, it's like proof.
Really?
Yeah, it's not formally established that scaling variant field theories in three dimensions are conformal. And that would be enormously important for condensed matter physics. Of course, in four dimensions, it's a slightly esoteric question, I agree, because there is no clear application. But this is the case in which it's easier to make progress, it seems.
It's important to say, you know, how surprising would it be that such theories exist?
Well, non-unitary theories exist as much as you want. I can write many. You can give many examples of non-unitary theories that are scaling variant but not conformal.
Do you know any interacting examples?
Yes, I know many non-interacting examples.
Of non-unitary?
Yeah, many. The first example was written by Ed Witten, which is what's called twisted n equals 2. If you...
Something.
No, it's completely fine.
The condensed matter. I thought that was your...
Oh, you're asking if they're in four dimensions.
Relevant dimensions.
Ah, in three dimensions. Yeah, I think twisted n equals 4 in three dimensions. I bet it would be not conformal in Harding. No, actually, this theory is completely fine. It's Lorentz invariant, it's Poincaré invariant. It's not unitary. And if you check the energy one transfer, it's not traceless. And it cannot be proved. So this is the simplest example I know, but there may be many others. So
question.
It's not completely esoteric in this sense. Yeah.
So the Friedman Maxwell in 3D?
Maxwell in 3D, yes.
Isn't that that's not conformal?
That's right.
And isn't it scaling invariant?
Scaling variant.
But isn't that an example which already tells you that
example? Because that theory has the same space of operators and Hilbert space as a conformal theory.
Right.
So there is no, the three point function is fixed, everything is the same as in the conformal field theory. It's just that there is a small, it's just that if you put it in curved space, it's not conformal, but in flat space, it's perfectly conformal.
Do we know any other example which are not just dual to it, but which are similar?
The belief. By and large, is that there aren't any interesting interacting unitary examples. I mean, one can ask why the hell unitarity has something to do with scale versus conformal? Why do you need unitarity to establish the existence of special conformal transformations? It's not clear. And even this four-dimensional story, which is almost complete, does not shed light on that. I mean, you use unitarity all the time, but it's not clear where it does. Why is there any connection between unitarity and special conformal transformations? But it's believed that there are no examples even in three dimensions, as far as I know.
Should we expect that generically it should be true even without unitarity?
No, I told you there are tons of counterexamples.
Oh, how many tons? And the only one that you gave is this.
This is the simplest one. I can give you many of this type. It's not bizarre. It's just a complete one.
In any case, your examples are isolated. I said generically. Okay. You had a manifold. SFTs, I think that SFTs would be...
So first of all, in two dimensions, there are tons of counterexamples. Let's start from two dimensions. In two dimensions, because sigma models with non-compact target spaces are non-conformal. Is that right, Joe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They can be.
So even in two dimensions, if you give up on unitarity, there is a zoo of non-conformal theories that are scale invariant.
The nice example is made up by John, which is if they have a theory of elasticity. It's a vector field.
Yeah, but that's free. He doesn't want free. He doesn't like free.
Well, I think that is free.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Actually, that's the point.
Well, the
effect is true. That if you have an RG flow, which reaches, that's where genericity will come in. Because RG flows, since it flows through a bunch of theories, you expect that when you reach something in Cryet, that's going to be generic. And so the conjecture would be that generically, any RG flow would give in the infrared a conformal theory.
I believe this is not true. Because most of these non-compact Calabi, non-compact sigma models in two dimensions are not conformal. And they are very easily reached from RG flows from GLSMs.
Could you exclude them by finding a discrete spectrum?
Yeah, by definition.
So could that be a possible conjecture?
That's not just a conjecture, that's the theorem that Joe proved in 18.
If you had a discrete spectrum without acquiring unitarity?
No, then we don't know. Then we don't know. That's an open question, right?
Yeah.
No, we don't know.
In 3D, I still believe it can be true.
Remains for the future to decide. Okay, thank you.